I next met with Dr. Adam Browski just before he was about to present at ASCO an update of a major randomized trial, the so-called Ribbon 2 study, of the anti-VEGF agent bevacizumab in the second-line setting, data that would reveal a trend toward an overall survival benefit in patients with triple-negative disease. Dr. Browski began by commenting on clinical and regulatory issues related to bevacizumab.
There are rare but severe side effects like pulmonary embolus and bowel perforation that we have to be careful of, as well as the not as catastrophic but still serious side effects such as hypertension and proteinuria. But on the other hand, I think we're struggling trying to figure out where the place of the drug is. And that's really reflective on, you know, the ODAC votes one way, the NCCN votes another to still continue these. The Europeans vote one way, the Americans vote another in terms of whether these really should still be in clinical practice.
Maybe you could describe a patient, assuming you can get it paid for, that you'd be likely to utilize chemo-bev and a patient who you'd be unlikely to utilize it.
I think really the second-line setting. I think even though it's not the approved setting, I think right now second-line triple-negative, I would give chemo with bev. I think that's right now where my thinking is going at this point in time. Would I give it first-line with bev? Probably. It really depends on the person. I think someone who I thought, you know, maybe had bulkier disease, someone who really is not at a risk for, say, you know, hemorrhage or thrombosis, someone with a decent performance status, say a younger woman, bulky triple negative disease, has progressed within a reasonable amount of time, maybe a year, 18 months after her adjuvant therapy, I would really think about chemo with Bev. I think that's where I would use it in that setting. As well as somebody who had triple negative disease, has gone through their first line of therapy, whether it's, you know, one of the PARP trials or the PARP Expanded Access Program or some other therapy, I would really seriously think about second-line chemo with Bev in that setting, if I can get it paid for. Now, clearly, the insurers are cracking down quite heavily on that. It's very difficult to get second-line Bev paid for in a lot of settings. So,
why are you thinking second-line rather than first-line?
Based on the Ribbon 2 data. I mean, you can do it first and second-line, but it really appears that there may be a signal there in second-line. Now, the issue becomes, you know, there's a signal in first line, signal in second line. Is there a signal to continued first, second, third, just like with trastuzumab? I don't know. That's the so-called Ribbon 3 design, which we pushed to do for quite a number of years. And they actually are doing a smaller version of that in Europe at the present time. Those are the kind of people I would do. The kind of person I probably, you know, so aggressive-ish kind of tumors, the kind of tumors you used to, and if you're still thinking of combination chemotherapy for somebody, you know, say two cytotoxics together. If you're thinking of two cytotoxics, I think it's reasonable to also think of a cytotoxic in Bev. That's maybe how I would view this temporarily. I mean, I think, again, I'm ambivalent. I'm as ambivalent as most people about this, even though I'm one of the PIs of one of the trials, that we're not quite sure who is going to benefit from this. It's not going to be all subsets. So the kind of person I probably wouldn't give it to is someone, say, who's got ER-positive breast cancer, slowly progressive, long disease-free interval before they had metastatic disease, doesn't have a lot of cancer. So say a 65, 68-year-old woman with a few bony metastatic lesions who's progressed through, say, one or two or three hormone therapies, you're thinking about chemo. I probably wouldn't use chemo with Bev and her.
How about choice of chemo? Now, the patient you just described, what likely would you use?
The last one?
Yeah.
Probably capecitabine.
Yeah,
I think a lot of us would use capecitabine in that setting.
Incidentally, what kind of schedule are you using nowadays with capecitabine?
Interestingly, we all use different ones. Let me talk about the dose. I think we all think the dose is too high. The label dose is too high. That's number one. And so generally, a lot of us will start somebody like that on 3 to 4 pills, 500 milligram tablets BID. And again, that works out to about a little under 2 grams per meter squared per day. But I think that a lot of us are starting to use the schedule that was popularized, I think in an abstract, I don't know if it's been published yet, by people at Memorial Sloan Kettering, where you'd the one-on, one-off schedule. So 1 week on, 1 week off, 1 week on, 1 week off. I've started to use that quite a bit in my practice.
What about other patients, as you describe patients, kind of bulkier disease, more trouble? What tends to be the agents that you use?
Usually taxanes, be it NAB, paclitaxel, be it docetaxel, depending really whether they come in. That depends on a few things. I mean, I think that number one, it depends on their coverage. I think I really like nab-paclitaxel. It's a very easy drug to give. Actually, you know, I was very skeptical when it first came out, but I got to tell you, it really surprises me not having to use steroids in people, especially older people, and giving it as a weekly therapy, which is what I do. I don't give it Q3 weeks like in the label. But giving weekly nanoparticle paclitaxel is a very well-tolerated regimen in a broad variety of patients. But the problem with it is that it's extraordinarily expensive, and a lot of insurers don't pay for it. So in that case, then, we then have paclitaxel, which is generic. It's less expensive. I'll use that weekly in a weekly regimen if I can. If someone cannot come in weekly, because I have a lot of patients that come to see me from a long distance, I'll use Q3 weekly docetaxel. Those are just my go-to regimens. Now, I used to add gemcitabine to that as combination therapy. I've kind of gotten away from that. You know, and it's just been kind of a subtle thing over the last couple of years. I think it's been more that I'm not 100% sure. You know, I used to be a big proponent of combination cytotoxics, and I've kind of moved away from that, mainly because they're biologicals that you combine in a lot of cases, like bevacizumab. But I'm just not sure the additional benefit is worth the additional cost to the patient in terms of another regimen and extra toxicity. So I generally, even in bulky disease, tend to try to use single agents. Now, occasionally, if someone has really bulky disease, say with, you know, impending visceral crisis in lungs or liver, someone whose LFTs or, you know, maybe their bilirubin is about 2, 2.5, and if they don't get a good response, it's going to be 5, I will think about combination cytotoxics in that kind of patient. But that's kind of what my go-to regimens are up front. I really don't use a lot of anthracyclines anymore. That's another thing I don't do as much of.
What about farther down the line, ixabibulone, eribulin, or a couple new agents on board?
I generally use ixabibulone as a single agent. I use it even though it's not labeled that way, based on some of the phase 2 data that's come out. I use ixabibulone as a weekly therapy when I can, at 16 per meter squared per week, 3 on, 1 off. I use that generally second, third, fourth line. I generally use it later lines. My go-tos are generally upfront. In fact, the way we work it in the University of Pittsburgh, as well as in our, we're in a kind of a, not an almost unique situation, I think, in that we really have worked extraordinarily closely with our community oncologists. We have two large practices that are basically part of our group now. And so we've come up with clinical pathways, which are a little bit different than the NCCN pathways in that we had groups of 4 academic oncologists and 4 community oncologists that come together and collaboratively pick the regimen for each stage of disease. So, you know, what we do is we pick efficacy first, toxicity second, and then obviously, you know, we don't want to lose money on agents. And so that's a third. That really is third. And it's very, very tightly controlled. And everybody buys into it. And again, this is a practice probably of 75, 80 oncologists now.
So how specific are
to the exact regimen?
So what exactly is it?
So our first line right now is paclitaxel bevacizumab in the first line. If someone does not tolerate steroids, it's nanoparticle paclitaxel bevacizumab.
What about diabetics?
Diabetics, that sort of thing. If steroids are contraindicated. So that's what I meant by not tolerate steroids. Okay. So if steroids are not contraindicated, be it for whatever reaction reason, diabetics, it's nanoparticle paclitaxel bevacizumab. If someone can only come in every 3 weeks for therapy, it's docetaxel with or without bevacizumab. I think we're still debating that one. Right now it's without. Again, reflecting the ambivalence about which drugs work with it or not. And then we actually still have, if someone really wants to get a rapid response, if rapid response needed, our go-to regimen in our pathway is gemcitabine and docetaxel. All these are based on randomized phase 3 studies.
How about second line?
So second line, again, it gets very complicated. The go-to regimen if someone has had a taxane is going to be capecitabine. That's our second line regimen. And it's without bevacizumab right now because it's not FDA approved. And again, the Ribbon 2 data is kind of percolating out. But again, it gets very complicated because if someone had a paclitaxel or a docetaxel in the adjuvant setting, progress very rapidly within 12 months, then probably we would use capecitabine as a first line. In fact, we have capecitabine as a first line. We say oral therapy desired. We say capecitabine.
So what about beyond that?
Beyond that, then, again, we have a specific third, fourth, fifth. But on the other hand, then it gets a little bit hard. What we're trying to do, actually, is say you can use any one of these. But generally, we have gemcitabine as a single agent, ixabibulone. We don't use ixabibulone, capecitabine together in our practice. We think it's too toxic. We generally have ixabibulone. We have liposomal encapsulated doxorubicin. We use that, any one of those regimens. And then we actually have now introduced eribulin now into that. So again, people will generally, if they can tolerate it, go through up to 6 different regimens they're allowed.
What's your actual clinical experience with eribulin?
I've just started to use it. I think it's hard to know whether it's going to replicate because, again, I think looking at the data from the eribulin study at ASCO, I'm very interested and very intrigued by it. I think that what's kind of interesting is that there really is not much of a difference in progression-free survival or response, but there's a very nice difference, a statistically significant difference in survival. And that may be one hypothesis. Again, it's hard to know whether it's true or not, but one hypothesis is that the eribulin, you know, somehow if you get a response in the liver, you don't go into liver failure, so you live longer.
So when I saw you before we came in, the first thing you said was, Neil, I want to talk to you about the email on bisphosphonates you wrote. And you've really been in the middle of this controversy. What are your thoughts?
So it turns out that there's data that's now over a decade old, where a guy, Ingo Diehl, in Germany, did a very nice trial looking at pamidronate.
I actually interviewed Ingo Diehl, incidentally.
Did you really?
A long time ago.
Good, cool. Absolutely cool. And, you know, this is Ingo Diehl's paper. It's 1996, and I remember this. We all remember this. We're all kind of getting old enough in this business. But Ingo Diehl's paper was very interesting, that there was a bone metastasis-free survival advantage in women receiving pamidronate. A very small trial. I think it was 150 women. It's like 75 per arm. That apparently persisted. I think it kind of went away after about 10 years. I think he did an update of it a couple years ago. But that was kind of interesting. And then there was some data. As I remember, the ASCO was 2003, where there were two competing studies, one from Royal Marsden and I think one from Denmark, Scandinavia, that came out with opposite results, that oral clodronate actually had a progression-free and overall survival, or a disease-free survival benefit in certain subsets of women who were taking it. Speaking and these were very large trials.
Speaking of history, actually, the UK Marsden study was presented right after the ATAC trial in, I think it was 2001.
Yep.
It was back-to-back. And Mike Baum, who presented the ATAC trial, said, this is perfect because we need something for their bones. Now
you got it. Absolutely. And a lot of us picked up on that and said, gosh, you know, these are really weak oral bisphosphonates. They're not that strong. Why don't we go with some of the bigger guns that we have? And we knew zoledronic acid was one of the more powerful ones. You can give it once or twice a year. And we had a huge debate, actually. I remember this. And that's actually the genesis of the SWOG 0307 trial. Is that, you know, we had this huge debate at the time trying to figure out what the proper dose of it was going to be. We settled on, at least for certain trials, on twice a year. So zoledronic acid was given twice yearly. And initially, again, we picked in the early stages of these trials. We had the ZFAST study, which I did with some other people, the ZOFAST trial and the extended ZOFAST, all with the same design, which was letrozole with or without zoledronic acid, looking predominantly at bone loss. Okay, kind of picking up on those comments that were made at ASCO 2001 and looking at bone loss. But in the back of all of our minds, we knew about the Ingo Diehl data. We knew about the data with clodronate from the Royal Marsden and from Scandinavia. And we said, gosh, you know, we really ought to, and we really pushed hard, you know. But again, they had this overall strategy where if they were going to do a disease-free and an overall survival trial, they wanted to do it in the context of the cooperative groups. And, you know, they wanted to do a big, big study, 5,000-6,000 women. They didn't want to do a small one. And that's fine. And so as a result, you know, we used survival. The trials we did were not powerful disease-free survival. They were really bone marker studies, you know, osteoporosis studies, bone density studies. And obviously, you know, not surprisingly, they showed better bone density with zoledronic acid. I mean, to preserve your bone density, no surprise, but was also very interesting. And this is data now I published almost 4 years ago showing the trends toward a survival benefit. Even at 1 year, we had a disease-free survival benefit in the women getting zoledronic acid. And again, these were very small, underpowered studies, but it was surprising we still saw a difference.
And now I think, wasn't that San Antonio, one of the other ones, had reported the same thing?
Right. And so what happened was, and then Michael Gannat had been doing a slightly different trial where he was taking premenopausal women, treating them.
The Austrian study.
The Austrian study. He was taking premenopausal women and treating them with the way they treat them in Europe, really, it was strongly ER positive, which I think is the way we're going to start treating women in the U.S. now, you know, with low oncotype, just as an example, even premenopausal women, where they treated premenopausal women with LHRH agonist, tamoxifen, and anastrozole with or without zoledronic acid. And Michael Gannat's data got presented, actually, it was the plenary session 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago at ASCO, where they showed a disease-free survival benefit in the women receiving the zoledronic acid. And these were premenopausal women with suppressed estrogen. And so everybody got very, very excited about this data. And it goes even further. I mean, this got Rowan Choblowski all excited. You know, and he went back and looked at the Women's Health Initiative data and saw women controlling for all these variables, because very complicated thing to control for. It was very well done. I really take my hat off to those guys, because people with low bone mass probably have less breast cancer anyway, et cetera. But be that as it may, they control for all those variables. And women who took oral bisphosphonates, predominantly alendronate actually in that, had almost a 30 to 40% reduction in the incidence of primary invasive breast cancer.
So there you're talking about new breast cancers
new
as
breast
opposed
cancers.
To recurrence.
As opposed to recurrence. So, you know, you have four or five trials all going the same way. And obviously, none of them, I mean, obviously, Women's Health Initiative is a retrospective analysis. The other trials I just talked about really looked at bone mass and were, I mean, with the exception of ABCSG, were really not powered for survival. And so, you know, Rob Coleman and his European colleagues did a tremendous trial. I mean, Azure, which was the trial. It all packaged, all fit together into a nice package. And just to kind of recap Azure again.
And that was presented at San Antonio.
To recap Azure, the idea was to give women standard of care for their disease. They had to be stages 2 or 3, so they were women with a higher than normal risk of recurrence, not the typical stage 1 or 2 crowd. They could be estrogen receptor negative or positive. This is all pre-stratified for at the beginning. They could be pre- or postmenopausal, pre-stratified at the beginning, and that's very important as we start talking about this data. And it was a large trial. It was 3,300 women. And the interesting thing about it is that, again, first of all, the zoledronic acid was given in a fairly intensive regimen. It was monthly for 6 months, then every 3 months, I think, for about a year and a half, then every 6 months for another 2 years, 2.5 years. And again, we have been conditioned as clinical investigators, as oncologists, to kind of look for these intermediate endpoints for disease-free survival. And lo and behold, it had a great one. The 200 women in the Azure study who got neoadjuvant zoledronic acid, there was 100 who got it, 100 who didn't. Of the 200 who got neoadjuvant therapy, their pathologic complete response rate was doubled. It was like 11% versus 6. And everybody was really excited. You know, you have all of this great clinical trials data pointing in one direction. There was data now from a randomized trial, although small, showing an intermediate endpoint that was positive. Yes, the one thing we can never explain is how the stuff worked. No one knew. Why would suppressing someone's bone result in progression or disease-free survival difference? No one could explain it. And so we said, okay, let's wait for Azure, and then we kind of wave our hands and figure it out. Well, lo and behold, as you said in your email a few weeks ago, it did not meet its primary endpoint. I mean, it was as flat as it could be.
0.98.
Right. The hazard ratio was basically 1, you know, when you looked at everybody. But what I think is the really important thing, and that was kind of missed, I think, by a lot of people. Not really missed, but I think not as emphasized as much. And Rob Coleman, when he presented this at San Antonio, emphasized this in his presentation.
Absolutely.
You know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Is that the women who had suppressed estrogen, who were postmenopausal, had not only a disease-free survival benefit, but an overall survival benefit. And it didn't matter whether their disease was ER positive or ER negative. And 90% of the women on the trial got chemo. So you have a postmenopausal woman with ER negative disease getting chemo. If she got zoledronic acid, she had an overall survival benefit. Now, how do you explain that? That's the weird thing about it. But it's there. The data is the data. Either you could be a statistician and say we looked at too many subgroups, but it was pre-specified. You know, that
lines up with the Austrian data.
It lines up precisely, just as he showed in his presentation, lines up with the Austrian data very nicely. So I think there's something there. So here's what we do, and this is kind of how I'm looking at this now. So as oncologists, as clinical investigators, we make a model, and we see if the model makes a prediction, and we see if the prediction is right. So the prediction now is that if we look at the SWOG-0307 trial, Julie Grelow is the PI of that. That's
comparing
an intergroup
study. Comparing 3-bisphosphonates.
Using 3-bisphosphonates. There's no control group. But what there is that there's a premenopausal group and a postmenopausal group. All right? And you should be able to see within a couple years, our model predicts that the premenopausal group will have no benefit and the postmenopausal group will have a benefit.
Benefit in terms of what?
Disease-free survival at this point in time.
Which arms?
Probably all three.
But there's nothing to compare it to.
No, but there will be. So here's the prediction. If the model is correct, and who knows, it may not be correct, but if the model that we've produced right now, so the model says this, somehow suppression of bone, and we could talk about the science behind it in a few minutes if you want, somehow the suppression of bone causes a reduction in metastases. How that works, we don't know. But when bone gets overactive in postmenopausal women, all right, they have a trend toward worse disease-free and overall survival in the adjuvant setting. Suppressing that bone prevents that. The stronger bone suppressants will do better. So in other words, it predicts that DCARE, which is denosumab versus placebo, should work in the postmenopausal group, potentially better than zoledronic acid. It predicts that zoledronic acid should work better than ibandronate, which should work better than clodronate in that randomized trial that Julie did and her collaborators. So we did it too. We put a lot of people on it, put 190 people on the trial in our group. So basically, that's what the model predicts. And I believe that trial is going to be looked at for the pre- and postmenopausal group within the year.
Well, the other thing that's kind of interesting is at ASCO, there was a paper in myeloma presented by the MRC group.
Correct.
Where they compared zoledronic acid to clodronate. Again, no control. And the patients on zoledronic acid live longer.
Correct.
So maybe, like you said, the SWOG thing, you'll see the same thing.
That's the prediction. That's the prediction of the model that we're creating now. Whether that works or not, we don't know. I mean, nature is messy. And I think that, you know, some medicine is messy. It may not be a clean result. But on the other hand, I think that the bottom line is that we all really were looking forward to this. Had it been positive, it clearly would have become standard of care. It's one of those trials that had it shown a benefit, I think, for all patients, it would have been standard of care. I think the fact that it didn't show a benefit, I think people have gone a little bit too much the other way and saying we should just throw it out.
So have you, let's say over the last year, been offering bisphosphonates purely for adjuvant therapy outside a protocol setting?
I have been doing it since the INGO-DEAL trial, believe it or not. I have a woman who had 12 nodes positive. Again, you can't really speak from anecdotes, but I had a woman who had 12 nodes positive. This is 1998, and I gave her pimidronate for a year. She's still alive. She's probably still been alive whether I gave it to her or not. I mean, it's only an anecdote. But
So you've been doing it.
I have, but again, in very certain cases. I think that clearly in the postmenopausal women, especially those with bone densities that are trending toward the low end.
Now you're getting into the bone thing. No,
I know, but the thing
adjuvant.
Is that there's still 30% of the adjuvant women that you take care of could get bisphosphonates for bone density reasons only. So you can punt that question. But the ER-negative, with ER-negative cancer, who is premenopausal, who has a normal bone density if you even decide to do it, which you may not even do because she's like 45 years old, would I be using bisphosphonates in them? I would have thought about it for certain women with a lot of nodes, and I have done it occasionally. I think after Asia, after this presentation, I'm probably not going to do that anymore.
So what about denosumab? Where do you see it fitting in breast cancer? Not just in this situation where obviously we need the data, but sort of theoretically, how do you think it's going to function in terms of adjuvant? And then what about metastatic disease?
Well, let me just start with denosumab and say that there's, you know, again, going back to the bone kind of thing, I just want to mention one last thing that's not a breast cancer thing, but actually, apparently, there is data that I just heard about that's going to be presented somewhere, or has been presented, I think, at ASCO GI, that someone looked at one of the big epidemiologic studies looking at bisphosphonate use in colon cancer and found less colon cancer. So that's one. But denosumab at ASCO GU, I think the rumor that I've heard, and again, I don't know this, I'm not a GU person, but the rumor I've heard is that in castrate-resistant prostate cancer without bone mets, that giving denosumab results in a bone met progression-free advantage. So again, suddenly you now have, you may be having this data coming out in other diseases. So this whole concept of bone suppression as an anti-metastatic kind of tool is something that needs some more investigation. But be that as it may, so let me kind of talk generally about denosumab. So denosumab, I think, does beat zoledronic acid in head-to-head trials of skeletal-related events in breast cancer with bone metastases to the degree that zoledronic acid beat pimidronate when you go back and look at the comparative studies. And so, therefore, if one argues that you should have gone to zoledronic acid for pimidronate, you ought to argue you should go from zoledronic acid to denosumab. The big difference between the two, there's really two differences that I see. One, denosumab is very expensive. It's right now double the price. And so, you know, you've got the convenience of not having to give an IV, not having to check renal labs because of a renal insufficiency. I mean, you still have to do all the precautions for osteoporosis of the jaw, which occurs at roughly the same amount. But, you know, it's something that I think is very attractive. But the other thing that we don't have with denosumab, though we do have a zoledronic acid, we don't have long-term data. I mean, most of the clinical trials really only go out a year to 2 years and everything. When zoledronic acid has been used, that there are now data sets. We have one that we're trying to publish. It'll probably get out there in the next couple of months, probably. MD Anderson, I think, has an extended data set beyond 2 years, showing that we have a good toxicity profile of the drugs beyond 2 or 3 years with zoledronic acid. Because really, that's one of the mysteries, is what do you do after 2 years? And we have data, at least, after 2 years with zoledronic acid, some, not a lot, at least toxicity data, where we have none with denosumab. And, you know, NK kappa beta inhibition, which is what this does, you know, it's hard to know what it does long term. Probably nothing in the end of the day, if I had to guess, but it's just the unknown of it. So those are the two major differences between them. But I'll tell you, if price wasn't an issue, I think that using denosumab first line is likely going to be where a lot of people are going to go.
Just out of curiosity, and it kind of relates to this case you're going to bring up, what do you do with someone who has metastatic breast cancer to the bone, who's been out there 2 years, stable, maybe on hormone? I mean, do you keep the bisphosphonate or zoledronic acid going?
I do. So we actually, I had a medical resident, a fellow, analyze. We have a database of about 800 women with metastatic breast cancer in our practice that goes back almost 12 years. And we looked at long-term bisphosphonate use, so people who got it for more than 2 years, and we found about 200 women in our practice who got it. And interestingly enough, we looked at the frequency. 95% of those women with a median of 5 years got it monthly. So that's been my practice, basically, is to continue it. And if you look at the ASCO guidelines for bisphosphonates, which are kind of weird when you really look at them, but they say continue till symptomatic deterioration. It's a very generic way of looking at it. It doesn't say stop after 2 years for scleroderma events. It says continue until symptomatic deterioration. But I think that's very interesting. So I don't remember. I think you probably have polled. Have you polled oncologists how long they use it after 2 years? How many use them after 2 years?
I don't think in breast cancer. We've done it in myeloma, but not breast cancer.
Yeah, myeloma, there's more of a rationale for it because there's anti-tumor effect.
Yeah, I don't know what people do. We ought to add that one in. I don't think so.
Yeah. I generally, my practice has been to continue it. And I have, again, because hormone-sensitive metastatic breast cancer, people live a long, long time. No, a lot of people do it more than 2 years.
Let me throw out one more thing to you. You mentioned Oncotype before, and I know you work closely with the NSABP. They had a presentation at San Antonio, which kind of tries to get into the issue of what you were referring to of biology versus anatomy. Any thoughts about how to factor in sort of clinical factors on top of the Oncotype?
I think we're all trying to struggle with that. I think that clinical factors probably to some degree are important. And I still think what we're struggling with in things like Oncotype, these multi-gene assays, is what is the relative contribution of each. I think the other major trend in this is that there are some very, very, very good immunohistochemists who can probably replicate the results of Oncotype just using traditional immunohistochemistry. The problem is that the people with that kind of expertise, being able to reproducibly do it, are few. Not to say anything bad about pathologists, but there are people who do nothing but immunohistochemistry of breast cancer. They're very good at it. And those are the ones that speak the loudest, saying, we don't need these multi-gene assays because I can do the immunohistochemistry just as well. And we saw, I think, at ASCO last year or at San Antonio a year ago, you know, looking at this IHC4 score versus the Oncotype test, showing that it's just as good in some cases. And Oncotype doesn't add more. One doesn't add more to the other. But this recent data shows that some clinical pathologic variables do add some. I have to kind of really investigate that a little bit more. I think that I kind of looked over that abstract and the presentation, and I'm still trying to figure that one out. I'm not sure where to go with it. I'm still a believer that biology still is probably better than anatomy.
So does that mean you're utilizing, for example, the Oncotype in some patients with node-positive disease?
Yeah, so here's the typical patient I would use the Oncotype in with node-positive disease. Say, postmenopausal, definitely with IHC-positive nodes. So people who, now the data actually that's come out in the last, both at ASCO and San Antonio suggest, behave just like node negative. So definitely with IHC positive nodes, but now even with 1 to 3 nodes positive. Someone with a very strong estrogen receptor, very, you know, kind of a lowish Ki-67, say 10%, 5%. I will basically do an Oncotype on them. And we get it paid for in our part of the country for postmenopausal women. Where the real stretch is now starting to come in my thinking is, a premenopausal woman, you're going to put on an LHRH agonist for the same disease for node-positive breast cancer like you do in Europe and not give her chemo, or theoretically not give her chemo. Wouldn't that work? Say you have a woman, say, suppose she's not 65. Say she's 45, comes in 45 years old, estrogen receptor, H score, say almost 300, say 280, Ki-67 of 10%, typical patient I saw last week, doesn't really want to lose her hair, doesn't want to go through chemo, 1 to 3 nodes positive, premenopausal. There's no data out there right now, but one would argue if biology does trump anatomy and you make her postmenopausal by giving her an LHRH agonist, should an Oncotype be predictive of her relative response to chemo and or hormonal therapy?
How often for the same tumor, same age, same general condition, does the patient's sort of attitude fit into this? You said this woman you saw last week really didn't want to lose her hair. How often is it, you know, you have people who come in and say, I got 3 kids, no matter what I need to do, I'll do it.
Yeah, and that's what people say. I think right now, until we have the science to back us up one direction or the other, I think we bring this out, just like bisphosphonates, just like you had mentioned a few minutes ago. It's just like bisphosphonates. I think that right now you kind of talk it through. It's your own attitude about it. It's kind of a patient who, in some cases, I would have given her, you know, this patient 5 years ago in the absence of a 21-gene assay, in the absence of Oncotype, I would have given this woman, you know, I would have talked to her, and I did this for several women. I would have given her an LHRH agonist and tamoxifen. I would have done that if she really was dead set against chemo. So I've had people come in, as usually I'm the second or third opinion by this time, I don't want chemo. There's just no way my grandma had it or my sister had it or someone had it and they died and I don't want it. That attitude has been important. But I think now that we have other tests like the Oncotype to help us make those decisions, I think the more subtle attitudes, you know what I'm saying? It's, in other words, you always had the definite attitudes, but now it's kind of shifting a little bit even to more subtle attitudes. No one wants chemotherapy in the end of the day, but most people will accept doing it if it has a benefit for them. And I think that's really what it comes down to. So attitude, to some degree, plays a point. It plays a point right now even in node-negative breast cancer. So what will happen is I'll have a woman come in and she'll have a tumor, a node-negative breast cancer that's ER-positive, and I'll say to her, look, would you want chemo no matter what we do? Given the potential benefit of chemo with your kind of cancer, it's a small benefit, but it's there. We just don't know the degree of it, and we could do Oncotype to help us figure that out. And she says, listen, I'm going to do chemo no matter what. And I says, so why waste the $3,000 doing the test? Let's just go ahead and do chemo. So attitude does play somewhat of a role.